Chapter 3. Guests. I hurriedly folded Gabarian's notes in four and stuck them in my pocket. I went slowly up to the locker and looked inside. The overalls and other clothing were squashed into a corner, as if someone had been standing in there. The corner of an envelope was poking out from under a pile of papers on the floor. I picked it up. It was addressed to me. My heart suddenly in my throat. I ripped the envelope open and had to force myself to unfold the small sheet of paper that was inside. In his even, tiny but legible handwriting, Gabarian had noted, "Yearbook of Solaristics, Volume 1, Appendix. Also, Minority Report by Messenger R.E. F. Bravincer's Minor Apocrypha." That was all. Not one word more. The writing showed signs of haste. Was this some kind of important information? When had he written it? I realized I needed to get to the library as soon as possible. I knew the appendix to the first volume of the Yearbook of Solaristics. That is to say, I knew of its existence, but I never had it in my hand, for it was of historical interest only. Ravincer, on the other hand, and his Minor Apocrypha, I had never even heard of. What should I do? I was already 15 minutes late. One more time from the door, I took in the whole room. It was only now that I noticed a folding bunk stowed vertically against the wall. It was hidden by a map of Solaris. Something had been hung behind the map. It was a miniature tape recorder in a case. I took out the recorder and returned the case to where it had been before. I checked the counter. Almost an entire reel had been used up. I slipped the recorder into my pocket. Once again, for a second, I stood by the door, my eyes closed, listening intently to the silence that reigned outside. Nothing. I opened the door. The corridor looked like a black chasm. It was only when I took off the dark glasses that I saw the faint ceiling lighting. I closed the door behind me and set off left to the radio station. I was close to the circular chamber from which corridors branched off like the spokes of a wheel. As I was passing a narrow side hallway leading, I think, to the bathrooms, I caught sight of a large, indistinct figure that almost merged into the background. I stood, rooted to the ground. From the far end of the side passage, a huge black woman was coming towards me with an unhurried, waddling gait. I saw the whites of her eyes glinting, and at almost exactly the same moment, I heard the soft slap of her bare feet. She had nothing on but a skirt that glistened yellow as if it were made of straw. She had massive pendulous breasts, and her black arms were as thick as a normal person's thighs. She passed 3 feet from me without so much as a glance, and walked off, her elephantine rump swaying like one of those steatopygic Stone Age sculptures found in anthropological museums. At the place where the corridor curved, she turned to the side and disappeared into Gabarian's cabin. When she opened the door, for a split second, she stood in the brighter light coming from inside. Then the door closed softly, and I was on my own. I took my left wrist in my right hand and squeezed with all my might till the bones cracked. I looked around distractedly. What had just happened? What had that been? All at once, as if I'd been struck, I recalled Snout's warning. What was it supposed to mean? Who had that monstrous Aphrodite been? Where had she come from? I took one, only one, step towards Gabarian's cabin and froze. I knew only too well I wasn't going to go in there. I sniffed the air with flared nostrils. Something was wrong. Something was out of place. That was it. I'd instinctively expected the distinct, repulsive odor of her sweat, but even when she passed a couple of feet from me, I hadn't smelled a thing. I don't know how long I stood there, leaning against the cold metal wall. The station was plunged in silence, the only audible sound the distant drone of the air conditioning compressors. I slapped myself lightly in the face and slowly made my way to the radio station. When I pressed down on the door handle, I heard a voice say sharply, "Who's there?" "It's me. Kelvin." He was sitting at a table between a pile of aluminum crates and the transmission console. eating meat concentrate straight from the can. I don't know why he chosen to set up quarters in the radio station. I stood at the door, dazed, staring at his regularly chewing jaws, and suddenly realized I was hungry. I went up to the shelves, took the least dusty plate from a pile, and sat down opposite him. For some time we ate without speaking. Then Snout stood up, took a thermos flask from a wall cabinet, and poured us each a cup of hot bouillon. Putting the thermos down on the floor, as there was no room on the table, he asked, "Have you seen Sartorius?"
"No. Where is he?"
"Upstairs."
Upstairs was the laboratory. We continued eating in silence till the metal scraped at the bottom of the empty can. Night reigned in the radio station. The window was tightly covered from the outside. The room was lit by four circular fluorescent ceiling lamps. Their reflections quivered in the plastic cover of the console. Red capillaries marked the taut skin on Snout's cheekbones. Now he was wearing a tattered, loose black sweater.
"Is something wrong?" he asked.
"No. Why would it be?"
"You're sweating."
I wiped my forehead with my hand. It was true. I was dripping with sweat. Must have been a reaction to the shock I just had. He scrutinized me. Should I tell him? I'd rather he'd have shown more trust in me. Who was playing against whom, and in what incomprehensible way?
"It's hot here," I said. "I thought your air conditioning would be working better."
"It'll catch up in an hour or so." "You sure it's only from the heat?"
He looked up at me. I chewed my food steadily as if I hadn't noticed.
"What do you mean to do?"
he asked finally, after we were done eating. He dropped the full dishes and the empty cans in the sink by the wall and came back to his chair.
"I'll fit in with your plans," I replied impassively. "You have a research program, right? Some new kind of stimulus, apparently X-rays or something like that?"
"X-rays?"
He raised his eyebrows.
"Where did you hear that?"
"I don't remember. Someone told me. On the Prometheus, maybe. Why? Is it already underway?"
"I don't know the details. It was Gabarian's idea. He started with Sartorius." "How could you know about it?"
I shrugged. "You don't know the details? You should have been a part of it. I mean, it's partly your area." I trailed off. He said nothing. The whine from the air conditioning quieted down, but the temperature remained at a tolerable level. There was merely a permanent high tone hanging in the air, like the buzz of a dying fly. Snout stood, went up to the console, and began flipping switches senselessly, since the main lever was in the off position. He fooled around like this for a while, then, still with his back to me, he remarked,
"It'll be necessary to complete the formalities regarding the... you know."
"Is that so?"
He turned and looked at me as if close to rage. I can't say I was deliberately trying to needle him, but not understanding any part of the game that was being played here, I preferred to be guarded. His bony Adam's apple moved up and down beneath the black turtleneck of his sweater.
"You were in Gabarian's room," he said abruptly.
I jerked my head as if to say, let's say I was. I wanted him to go on.
"Who was there?"
"He knew about her."
"No one?" "Who could have been there?" I asked.
"So why wouldn't you let me in?"
I smiled. I got scared. After your warning, when the handle moved, I grabbed it instinctively.
"Why didn't you say it was you? I'd have let you in."
"I thought it was Sartorius,"
he said unsurely.
"Well, what of it?"
"What do you think about what happened there?"
he said, answering a question with a question.
I hesitated. "You must know better than me.
Where is he?" "In the cold room," he replied immediately. "We moved him there right away in the morning, because of the heat."
"Where did you find him?"
"In a locker."
"In a locker? He was dead already?"
"His heart was still beating, but he wasn't breathing. He was in his death throes."
Did you try to save him?
No.
Why not?
He paused. I was too late. He died before I could lie him down.
He was standing in the closet? In amongst those overalls?
Yes.
He went up to a small desk in the corner and fetched a sheet of paper that had been lying on it. He placed it in front of me.
I wrote a kind of interim report, he said. It's actually good that you took a look at the room. Cause of death. Injection of a lethal dose of peristal. It's written here.
I scanned the brief text. Suicide, I repeated quietly. And the reason?
A nervous breakdown, depression, whatever it ought to be called. You know these things better than I do.
I only know what I can see myself, I replied, and looked up into his eyes, for he was standing over me.
What do you mean by that?
He asked calmly.
He injected himself with peristal and hid in a closet, yes? If that was the case, it wasn't depression or nervous breakdown. It was severe psychosis. Paranoia. He probably thought he was seeing something, I said, speaking ever more slowly and looking him in the eye. He walked off to the radio console and started flicking switches again. Your signature is here, I said after a moment's silence. What about Sartorius?
He's in the lab, I already told you. Doesn't come out. I'm assuming that...
That what?
That he's locked himself in.
Locked himself in? Oh, I see. Locked himself in. How about that? Perhaps he's barricaded the door?
Perhaps.
Snout, I said. There's someone on the station.
You seen?
He looked across at me as he leaned over.
You warned me. About who? Was it a hallucination?
What did you see?
It's human, yes?
He said nothing. He turned towards the wall as if he didn't want me to see his face. He drummed his fingers on a metal partition. I looked at his hands. There was no trace of blood on his knuckles. I had a flash of insight. That person is real, I said softly, almost in a whisper, as if I were telling him a secret that could be overheard. Right? She can be touched. She can be hurt. The last time you saw her was today.
How do you know?
He didn't turn around. He stood right by the wall, his chest leaning against it as my word struck him. Right before I landed. Not long before? He flinched as if from a blow. I saw the wild look in his eyes.
You!
He stammered out.
Who are you?
He looked as if he was about to pounce on me. That I was not expecting. The situation was upside down. So he didn't believe I was who I said I was? What was this supposed to mean? He was staring at me in absolute terror. Was he mad already? Poisoned? Anything was becoming possible. But I'd seen her, this creature. So then I, myself, also. Who was it? I asked. My words calmed him. For a moment, he eyed me as if he still didn't believe me. Before he even opened his mouth, I knew it had been a false move on my part and that he wouldn't answer me. He eased himself into an armchair and put his head in his hands.
Oh, the thing's happening here, he said in a low voice. Malignant fever.
Who was it? I asked once again.
If you don't know,
he murmured.
Then what?
Then nothing.
Snout, I said, we're far enough away from home. Let's play with open cards. Everything's complicated enough as it is.
What do you mean?
That you should tell me who I saw.
And you?
He retorted suspiciously.
You're losing it. I'll tell you and you tell me. You can rest assured I won't think you're crazy because I know. Crazy? Good God!
He tried to laugh.
You don't! You have no...
That would be a perfect solution. If he had believed for a moment it was madness, he wouldn't have done it. He'd still be alive.
So what you said in the report about a nervous breakdown was a lie?
Of course!
Well, why won't you write the truth?
Why? he repeated. There was a pause. Once again, I was completely in the dark. I didn't get a thing, though for a moment it seemed I'd managed to convince him to approach the mystery by combining forces. Why? Why wouldn't he say? Where are the automats? I put in.
In the depositories. We lock them all away, except for the docking bay service.
Why?
Again, he didn't answer.
You won't say?
I can't.
There was something in all this that I couldn't put my finger on. Maybe I should go upstairs and see Sartorius. I suddenly remembered the note, and at the present moment, that seemed the most important thing. Can you imagine going on working in these conditions? I asked.
He gave a contemptuous shrug.
What difference does it make?
Is that so? Then what do you intend to do? He said nothing. In the silence, the distant sound of bare footsteps could be heard. Amid the plastic and nickel-plated implements, the tall lockers with electronic equipment, glassware, and precision instruments, that ambling, lazy tread sounded like a stupid trick performed by someone with a screw loose. The sound was coming closer. I stood up, intently watching Snout. He was listening closely, his eyes narrowed to slits, but he didn't seem at all alarmed. So it wasn't her he was afraid of? Where did she come from? I asked. Then, when he hesitated to answer, do you not want to say?
I don't know.
All right. The footsteps receded and faded away. So it wasn't her he was afraid of? Where did she come from? I asked. Then, when he hesitated to answer, do you not want to say?
I don't know.
All right. The footsteps receded and faded away.
You don't believe me? He said. I give you my word I don't know.
I was silent. I opened a locker containing spacesuits and pushed aside their heavy empty shells. As I suspected, at the back, hanging on hooks, there were gas pistols used to move about in a gravitational vacuum. They weren't much use, but at least they were some kind of weapon. I preferred that to nothing. I checked the cartridge case and hung the strap of the holster over my arm. Snout was observing me watchfully. As I adjusted the strap, he bared his yellowed teeth in a mocking smile.
Happy hunting, he said.
Thanks for everything, I retorted, heading for the door. He jumped up from his armchair.
Kelvin!
I looked at him. He was no longer smiling. I don't know that I've ever seen such a tired-looking face.
Kelvin, it's not... I really can't,
he stammered. I waited to see if he'd say any more, but he just moved his lips as if he was trying to spit something out. I turned and left without a word. Chapter 4. Sartorius. The corridor was empty. It first led straight, then curved to the right. I'd never been on the station before, but as part of my preparatory training, for 6 weeks I'd lived in an exact copy of it on Earth, at the Institute. I knew where the aluminum steps led. The library was in darkness. I felt for the light switch. When I found the first volume of the Yearbook of Solaristics, along with its appendix in the index, a small red light came on as I pressed the key. I checked in the register. The volume had been checked out by Gabarian, along with another book, the aforementioned Minor Apocrypha. I turned the light off and went back downstairs. I was afraid to go into his cabin, despite the footsteps I'd heard before. She could have gone back there. For some time I stood outside the door, till eventually I gritted my teeth, got a grip on myself, and entered. The illuminated room was empty. I started rifling through the books scattered on the floor by the window. At a certain moment I went up to the locker and closed it. I couldn't look at that empty place among the overalls. The appendix was not to be found by the window. I went through each book in turn, till I got to the last pile that lay between the locker and the bed. There I found the volume I was looking for. I'd hoped to find some clue in it, and in fact, there was a bookmark inserted at the index of names. Underlined in red pencil was a name that meant nothing to me. Andre Burton. It appeared on two different pages. I found the first of these and learned that Burton had been the co-pilot on Shanahan's ship. The next mention of his name was over 100 pages later. Immediately after landing, the expedition had proceeded with extreme caution. But when, after 16 days, it transpired that the plasmic ocean not only showed no signs of aggression, but retreated from any object moved close to its surface, and, whenever it could, avoided direct contact with instruments or people, Shanahan and his second-in-command, Timilis, lifted some of the restrictions on activities that had been imposed as precautions, since these restrictions seriously impeded the work that was to be done. At that time, the expedition was divided into small 2- or 3-person teams, each carrying out flights over the ocean that were often several hundred miles in duration. The sweepers that had previously been used to close off the research area were left at the base. The first 4 days after this change of method went without any incident, aside from the occasional damage to the oxygen apparatus and the spacesuits, since the exhaust valves proved susceptible to the corrosive effect of the toxic atmosphere. Because of this, they had to be replaced almost daily. On the 5th day, or the 21st, counting from the moment of landing, 2 scientists, Carucci and Fechner, the first was a radiologist, the second a physicist, conducted an exploratory flight over the ocean in a small 2-person airmobile. It wasn't a flying craft, but a boat that moves on a cushion of condensed air. When they failed to return after 6 hours, Timilis, who was in charge at the base during Shanahan's absence, ordered the alarm to be sounded and sent all available personnel out to search for the missing men. By a disastrous coincidence, radio contact was lost that day about an hour after the search party set out. This was caused by a large sunspot on the red sun releasing a powerful burst of corpuscular radiation into the upper reaches of the atmosphere. Only ultra-shortwave equipment worked, allowing communication at a distance of no more than 12 or 15 miles. To make matters worse, before the sun set, the mist thickened and the search had to be interrupted. When the search parties were already on their way back to the base, one of them found the airmobile no more than 80 miles from the shore. Its engine was working, and the craft was drifting undamaged on the waves. Only one man, Carucci, was found in the cockpit, barely conscious. The airmobile was brought back to the base, and Carucci was given medical treatment. That same evening, he recovered. He was unable to say anything about what had happened to Fechner. He only remembered that when they'd already decided to head back, he had started to have difficulty breathing. The exhaust valve of his apparatus had been jamming, and at each in-breath, a small amount of toxic gas had gotten into his spacesuit. Fechner must have unfastened his seatbelt and stood up as he attempted to fix the other man's equipment. That was the last thing Carucci remembered. According to the experts, the probable subsequent course of events had been as follows. As he worked on Carucci's oxygen pack, Fechner had opened the roof of the cockpit, probably because it was low and cramped his movements. This was permissible, since on such craft the cabin is not hermetic anyway, and merely provides protection against wind and atmospheric conditions. During these operations, Fechner's own apparatus must have developed a fault. Growing lightheaded, he had climbed up through the roof, gotten under the top of the airmobile, and fallen into the ocean. Such is the story of the ocean's first victim. A search for the body, which ought to have floated on the waves in its spacesuit, was unsuccessful. Though it might have drifted, it was beyond the expedition's capabilities to comb thousands of square miles of undulating emptiness, almost permanently covered with stretches of mist. To return to the previous events, by nightfall all the search teams had returned, with the exception of a large freight helicopter that Burton had taken. He appeared over the base almost an hour after darkness had fallen, when there were already serious fears for his safety. He was in a state of nervous shock. He climbed out of the helicopter unaided, only to try to run away. Restrained, he shouted and wept. In a man with 17 years' experience of spaceflight, often in the most punishing conditions, this was quite extraordinary. The doctor suspected that Burton, too, was suffering from poisoning. Though he ostensibly regained his senses, he refused even for a moment to leave the expedition's main rocket ship, nor would he go up to the window from which the ocean could be seen. After 2 days, Burton declared he wished to submit a report concerning his flight. He insisted, claiming it was a matter of the utmost importance. When this report was examined by the expedition's advisory board, it was determined to be the morbid product of a mind poisoned by the toxic gases of the atmosphere. As such, it was included not in the records of the expedition, but in Burton's medical case history upon which the whole matter was closed. So much was said in the appendix. I surmise that the heart of the matter lay in Burton's actual report, what it was that had led a long-distance pilot to suffer a nervous breakdown. I looked once again through the piles of books, but I couldn't find the minor apocrypha. I was feeling more and more tired, so I put off further searching till the next day and left the cabin. As I passed the aluminum stairs, I saw patches of light from above. So Sartorius was still working at this hour. I decided I ought to pay him a visit. Upstairs it was a little warmer. There was a faint draft in the wide, low-ceilinged corridor. The strips of paper across the air vents were fluttering furiously. The door of the main lab consisted of a thick plate of textured glass in a metal frame. The glass had been covered with something dark from inside. Light issued only from a narrow window beneath the ceiling. I pressed on the bar. As I'd expected, the door did not yield. Inside, there was silence, broken from time to time by what sounded like the low hiss of a Bunsen burner. I knocked. There was no response.
"Sartorius?" I called out. "Dr. Sartorius, it's me, Kelvin, the new arrival. I have to see you. Open up, please."
There was a soft rustle, like someone walking on crumpled papers, then silence again.
"It's me, Kelvin. You must have heard about me. I arrived a few hours ago from the Prometheus," I said loudly, positioning my mouth close to the place where the metal door frame met the jamb. "Dr. Sartorius, there is no one else here, only me. Please open up."
Silence. Then the faint rustle again. A few clinking sounds, very distinct, as if someone were placing metal implements on a metal tray. Then, suddenly, I was thunderstruck. There came a series of tiny footsteps, like the toddling of a small child, a rapid, hurried patter of small feet. Perhaps someone was just imitating it, masterfully drumming their fingers on an empty box.
"Dr. Sartorius," I yelled, "are you going to open the door or not?"
There was no response, only that childlike pattering again, and at the same time a few rapid, barely audible, long steps, as if the person were walking on tiptoe. But if he was walking, surely he couldn't simultaneously imitate a child's footsteps. Though, what did I care, I thought to myself, and no longer holding back the anger that was building up in me, I roared,
"Dr. Sartorius, I haven't been traveling for 16 months just to be brought to a halt by some play-acting of yours. I'm counting to 10, then I'm going to break down the door."
I doubted it would work. Gas pistols aren't very powerful, but I was determined to carry out my threat one way or another, even if it meant looking for explosives, which for sure would be plentifully available in the depository. I told myself I mustn't give in. In other words, I mustn't keep playing with these cards, marked with madness, that the situation had stuck in my hand. There was a noise that sounded like someone wrestling with someone else, or pushing something. The dark sheet covering the inside of the door moved aside a foot and a half or so. A slender shadow appeared in the lusterless, frosted pane, and a slightly hoarse, high-pitched voice said,
"I'll open the door, but you have to give me your word you'll not come in."
"Then why open it?"
I thundered.
"I'll come out to you."
"All right, you have my word."
There was the faint click of a key turning in the lock. Then the dark silhouette covering half the door carefully pulled the cover back in place. Some kind of complicated maneuvers were carried out inside. I heard what sounded like the creak of a wooden table being moved. Then finally the door opened just enough to allow Sartorius to slip out into the corridor. He stood before me, shielding the door with his body. He was extremely tall and thin. Under his cream-colored undershirt, his body looked to be nothing but bones. He wore a black scarf around his neck. A folded lab coat dotted with reagent burns was draped over his arm. His narrow head was tilted to the side. Almost half his face was hidden behind a pair of wraparound black glasses, so I couldn't see his eyes. He had a long lower jaw, bluish lips, and huge ears that were also blue and looked frostbitten. He was unshaven. Red rubber anti-radiation gloves hung from his wrists on loops. We stood for a moment, eyeing each other with unconcealed animosity. What was left of his hair, he looked as if he'd given himself a buzz cut, was the color of lead, while his beard was completely gray. His forehead was sunburned like Snout's, but the color ended at a horizontal line halfway to his hairline. He'd evidently worn some kind of cap the whole time he was in the sun.
"How can I help you?"
he said finally. I had the impression he wasn't waiting to see what I would say, so much as listening closely to the space behind him, his back pressed up the whole time against the glass pane of the door. For a good while, I couldn't think of how to open without sounding foolish. "My name is Kelvin. You must have heard about me," I began. "I am, or rather, I was, Gabarian's colleague." His skinny face, crisscrossed with horizontal lines, this was what Don Quixote must have looked like, was expressionless. The bulging black surface of the dark glasses directed towards me made it extremely hard for me to talk. "I heard that Gabarian passed away." I paused.
"Yes, how can I help?"
He sounded impatient.
"Did he commit suicide? Who found the body, Doctor, you or Snout?"
"Why are you asking me? Didn't Dr. Snout not tell you?"
"I'd like to hear what you have to say about the matter."
"You're a psychologist, Dr. Kelvin?"
"Yes, what of it?"
"A scholar?"
"Well, yes. What relevance does that have?"
"I thought perhaps you were a detective or a police officer. It's 2:40, and you, Dr. Kelvin, instead of seeking to familiarize yourself with the work being conducted on the station, which would after all be understandable, despite your brutal attempt to break into the laboratory, you're questioning me as if I were at the very least a suspect."
I controlled myself, though the effort brought beads of sweat to my forehead.
"You are a suspect, Sartorius," I said through clenched teeth.
I wanted to needle him at any cost, and so I added unrelentingly, "as you're perfectly well aware."
"If you do not retract that remark and apologize, Kelvin, I shall bring a complaint against you in my next radio report."
"What am I supposed to apologize for? For the fact that instead of welcoming me, instead of properly briefing me on what's been happening, you lock the door and barricade yourself in the laboratory? Have you completely lost your mind? Are you a scientist or a coward, eh? What do you have to say for yourself?"
I don't know exactly what else I said. He didn't even flinch. Thick beads of perspiration were trickling down his pale, large-pored face. All at once I realized he wasn't even listening to me. He kept both his hands behind him, with all his strength holding the door shut. It was shuddering slightly, as if someone were pushing on it from the other side.
"You should go,"
he whined suddenly in a strange, shrill voice.
"You should... for the love of God, go now. Go downstairs. I'll come down. I'll do whatever you want, but please go."
There was such torment in his voice that, in a state of bewilderment, instinctively I raised my hand to try and help him keep the door shut, because that was evidently what he was struggling with. But he gave a fearful cry as if I'd threatened him with a knife, so I began to back away. He kept shouting in that high voice,
"Go! Go!"
And then,
"I'm coming back. I'll be back right away. No, no!"
He cracked open the door and darted inside. I thought I caught a glimpse of something gold-colored, like a shiny disc at the level of his chest. There now came a muffled commotion from inside. The cover over the door was knocked aside. A large, tall shadow flashed across the pane. The cover was put back in place, and nothing more could be seen. What on earth was happening in there? There was the sound of footsteps. The crazy ruckus broke off with a terrifying clatter of glass, and I heard a burst of laughter from a child. My legs were shaking. I looked around me. Everything fell silent. I perched on a low plastic windowsill. I sat there for perhaps 15 minutes. I couldn't say if I was waiting for something or had simply been brought to such a pass that I didn't even have it in me to stand. My head was splitting. Somewhere high up I heard a prolonged grinding sound, and at the same time the place grew lighter. From where I sat I could only see part of the circular corridor that ran around the laboratory. It was located at the very top of the station, right under the exterior armor plating. For this reason, the outside walls were concave and sloping, with windows like loopholes set into them every few yards. The external shades were just retracting as the blue day was drawing to a close. A blinding glare burst through the thick glass. Every nickel-plated piece of trim, every door handle, burned like a little sun. The lab door with its pane of rough glass glowed like the opening of a furnace. I looked at my hands, which lay in my lap, and had turned gray in this ghastly light. In the right, I was holding the gas pistol. I had no clue when or how I'd taken it out of its holster. I put it back. I knew by now that even an atomic blaster would be no use. What could I do with one? Break down the door? Force my way into the lab? I stood up. The disk descending into the ocean, looking like a hydrogen explosion, sent a cluster of almost material horizontal rays in my direction. When they struck my cheek, I was already walking down the stairs, it felt like a red-hot brand. Halfway down the steps, I changed my mind and went back up. I circled the lab. As I mentioned, the corridor ran all the way around it. After 100 yards or so, I found myself on its far side, outside an identical glass door. I didn't even try to open it. I knew it would be locked. I looked for some kind of window in the plastic wall, even just a chink. The idea of spying on Sartorius didn't seem at all dishonorable to me. I wanted to put an end to conjecture and learn the truth, though I couldn't imagine how I would understand it. It occurred to me that the labs were lit from skylights in the ceiling, or rather in the exterior plating, and if I went outside I might be able to see in from there. To this end, I'd need to go downstairs and get a spacesuit and oxygen tank. I stood by the stairs, wondering if it was worth the effort. The skylights were likely made of matted glass, but what other option did I have? I went down to the middle level. I had to pass by the radio station. The door was wide open. He was sitting in the armchair in the same position I'd left him in. He was asleep. At the sound of my footsteps, he stirred and opened his eyes.
"Hey there, Kelvin," he croaked.
I remained silent.
"So, did you find anything out?"
he asked. "Actually, yes," I replied slowly. "He's not alone." Snout made a face.
"Oh, about that. That's something. He has guests, you say?"
"I don't understand why none of you will say what it is," I put in, as if casually. "I mean, I'll be staying here, so sooner or later I'll find out anyway. So why all the secrets?"
"You'll understand when you have your own guests," he said.
I had the feeling he was waiting for something and wasn't in the mood to talk.
"Where are you going?"
he asked sharply when I turned around. I didn't reply. The docking bay was in the same state as when I'd left it earlier. My scorched capsule stood wide open on the pad. I went up to the spacesuit racks, but I'd suddenly lost interest in the idea of venturing out to the plating atop the station. I spun on my heel and went down the spiral stairs to where the depositories were. The narrow corridor was cluttered with canisters and piles of cases. The walls here were made of bare metal that glinted lividly in the light. A few dozen yards, and the frost-covered pipes of the cooling apparatus came into view beneath the ceiling. I traced them back. They disappeared via a thick plastic sleeve into a hermetically sealed room. When I opened the heavy door, which was 2 hands-widths thick and lined with rubber, a blast of cold chilled me to the bone. I shivered. Icicles hung from a tangle of snow-coated coils. Here, too, there were crates and capsules under a thin layer of snow. The shelves lining the walls were stacked with cans and yellow blocks of some kind of fat packed in clear plastic. Further off, the barrel-vaulted ceiling dropped lower. In this place, there was a thick curtain glittering with ice needles. I pulled it aside. A large, elongated shape lay on a pallet beneath a sheet of gray fabric. I raised the hem and looked into the stiffened face of Gibarion. His black hair with the gray streak over the forehead, lay flat against his skull. His Adam's apple jutted upwards, breaking the line of his neck. His dry eyes stared straight up at the ceiling. A cloudy tear of ice had formed in the corner of his eyelid. The cold was so piercing I had trouble preventing my teeth from chattering. Holding the shroud up with my other hand, I touched his cheek. It was exactly like touching frozen wood. The skin was rough with stubble, which poked through in small black points. An expression of boundless, disdainful patience had set on his lips. As I lowered the edge of the cloth, I noticed that on the far side of the body some elongated black beads, or beans, arranged from smallest to largest, were poking out from under the folds. All at once I was petrified. It was the toes of bare feet seen from underneath. The oval pads protruded somewhat. Beneath the crumpled edge of the shroud, pressed flat against the pallet, lay the black woman. She was face down, as if plunged in a deep sleep. I pulled aside the sheet, inch by inch. Her head, covered in small tufts of bluish hair, rested in the crook of her massive, equally black arm. The bumps of her spinal column tightened the glistening skin across her back. Her immense body showed not the slightest sign of movement. Once again I looked at the bottoms of her bare feet, and I was struck by something odd. They weren't flattened or squashed by the weight they must have had to carry. They weren't even calloused from walking barefoot, but were covered with a skin that was as thin as that on her back or hands. I tested this impression with a touch that was much more difficult than touching the dead body. What happened then was quite incredible. Her body, subjected to a temperature below 0 degrees Fahrenheit, came to life and stirred. She drew up her foot like a sleeping dog when you take hold of its paw. She'll freeze to death in here, I thought to myself. But her body was tranquil and not especially cold. I could still feel the soft touch moving through my fingertips. I stepped back behind the curtain, let it fall, and returned to the corridor. It felt extraordinarily hot out there. Stairs led me out to right by the docking bay. I sat on a furled parachute and took my head in my hands. I felt as if I'd been beaten up. I didn't know what was happening to me. I was shattered. My thoughts seemed to be moving along the edge of a cliff, in danger of falling off at any moment. Annihilation, or at least loss of consciousness, would have been an unutterable, unattainable act of grace. I had no reason to go see Snout or Sartorius. I couldn't imagine assembling into any kind of whole all I'd experienced, seen, touched with my own hands up to this point. The only resort, way out, explanation, was a diagnosis of insanity. Yes, I must have gone mad immediately after I landed. The ocean had affected my brain in such a way. I'd had one hallucination after another, and since this was the case, there was no point in wasting my energy on vain attempts to solve mysteries that in reality did not exist. But instead, I should seek medical assistance, call the Prometheus or another ship from the radio station, send an SOS. At this point, something happened that I scarcely expected. The thought that I had lost my mind calmed me down. I understood only too well what Snout had said. If, in fact, anyone called Snout even existed, and I had ever spoken to him, because, after all, the hallucinations could have begun much earlier. Who knows if I wasn't still on board the Prometheus, struck down by a sudden bout of mental illness, and everything I'd experienced at this point was the product of a disturbed mind. Yet, if I was sick, I could get better, and that at least gave me the hope of deliverance, something I couldn't remotely see being possible among the tangled nightmares of what I'd lived through on Solaris in the space of a few short hours. What I needed to do, then, was to conduct some kind of logically designed experiment on myself. An experimentum crucis, which would show me whether in fact I'd gone mad and was at the mercy of phantoms created by my own imagination, or whether, however absurd and improbable they were, these experiences were in fact real. I thought about it all as I gazed at the metal cantilever that supported the weight-bearing structure of the docking bay. It took the form of a steel mast jutting from the wall and reinforced with convex plates. It was painted willow green. In places, at a height of about 3 feet, the paint was coming off. It had probably been scraped by the rocket carts as they were moved that way. I touched the steel, warming it for a moment with my hand, and tapped the rolled edge of the protective casing. Was it possible for a hallucination to reach such a level of realism? Perhaps, I answered myself. After all, that was my area of specialization. I knew what I was talking about. But could such a critical experiment be designed? To begin with, I thought not, because my sick brain, if indeed it was sick, would produce any illusion I required of it. After all, it's not just in sickness. Even in the most ordinary dream we find ourselves conversing with people we do not know in our waking life, asking these dream figures questions and hearing their answers. When this happens, even though the figures are in fact only products of our own mind, parts of which have temporarily become detached and given a fake independence, we still don't know what words they will utter until, in that dream, they speak to us. Yet, in reality, the words are concocted by that other, separated part of our own mind. And so, we ought to know them at the moment we think them up and put them in the mouth of a fictional character. Whatever I might plan and carry out, then, I could always tell myself I was acting the way we act in dreams. Neither Snout nor Sartorius needed to even exist in reality, and so asking either of them questions was pointless. It occurred to me that I could take some powerful medication, like peyote, for example, or something else that produces hallucinations or graphic visions. Experiencing such things would prove that what I had taken really existed and was a part of the material reality surrounding me. But, I thought further, that too would not be the critical experiment I was after, because I knew how the substance, which I of course would have to select, ought to act on me, and so it could also be the case that both the taking of the medication and the effects it caused were equally products of my imagination. I was already thinking there was no way out of the vicious circle of madness. After all, no one can think with anything but his brain. No one can be outside himself to check whether the processes taking place in his body are normal. Then suddenly I was struck by an idea that was as simple as it was apt. I jumped up from the pile of parachutes and ran straight to the radio station. It was empty. I glanced at the electric wall clock. It was coming up to 4 in the agreed-upon night of the station, because outside a red dawn was breaking. I quickly turned on the long-distance radio equipment, and as I waited for the lamps to warm up in my mind, I went over the various stages of the experiment. I couldn't remember the call signal for the automatic station of the planetary satelloid, but I found it on the bulletin board over the main console. I called it up in Morse code. 8 seconds later came the response. The satelloid, or rather its electronic brain, reported in with a repeated rhythmic signal. I requested it to tell me which meridians of the galactic canopy it was passing at 20-second intervals as it orbited Solaris. I asked for figures to the 5th decimal place. Then I sat down and waited for the response. It came 10 minutes later. I tore off the paper printout with the results, stuck it in a drawer, making sure I didn't so much as glance at it first, then went to the library and brought back large-scale sky maps, logarithmic tables, the almanac of the satellite's daily movements, and a few additional books. I then proceeded to figure out my own answer to the same question. It took me almost an hour to set up the equations. I don't remember the last time I performed such difficult computations. It was probably in school during my practical astronomy exam. I carried out the work on the station's huge calculator. My reasoning was as follows. From the sky maps, I ought to derive figures that were not exactly the same as those provided by the satelloid, since the satelloid was subject to complex perturbations as a result of Solaris's gravitational pull, of its 2 mutually orbiting suns, and also local variations in gravitation caused by the ocean. When I had both sets of figures, those provided by the satelloid and those calculated theoretically on the basis of the sky maps, I'd correct my own reckonings. At this point, the 2 groups of results ought to match to the 4th decimal place. Discrepancies would remain only in the 5th decimal place, as being caused by the unpredictable influence of the ocean. Even if the figures the satelloid provided were not real, but a product of my own crazy mind, they still couldn't match the other series of numbers. Even if my brain was sick, It would not be capable under any circumstances of the computations performed by the station's calculator. Such a thing would have required months of work. So then, if the figures tallied, the calculator existed in reality, and I was actually using it, not just imagining I was. My hands were trembling as I took the telegraphic printout from the drawer and spread it out next to the other, wider sheet from the calculator. Both lists of figures matched, as I had predicted, to the fourth decimal place. Discrepancies appeared only in the fifth. I put all the papers into the drawer. So the calculator existed independently of me. This meant that the station and everything on it was also real. I was about to close the drawer when I noticed it was filled with a whole wad of papers covered in hasty calculations. I pulled them out. A single glance was enough to see that someone else had already carried out an experiment like mine, the only difference being that instead of data from the star canopy, this person had asked the satelloid for information about Solaris's reflectivity at 40-second intervals. I was not mad. The last ray of hope had faded. I turned off the transmitter, finished what was left of the bullion in the flask, and went to bed. Chapter 5. Hare. I'd carried out my calculations in a kind of silent doggedness that had been the only thing keeping me on my feet. I was so dazed by exhaustion that I couldn't figure out how to set up the bunk in the cabin. Instead of releasing the top latches, I just pulled on the rail, and all the bedding fell on me. When I finally got it down, I tossed my clothes and underwear on the floor, and barely conscious, dropped under the pillow, which I hadn't even properly inflated. I don't know when I fell asleep. The light was still on. When I opened my eyes, I had the feeling I'd only been sleeping a few minutes. The room was filled with a cloudy red glow. I felt cold, and I felt fine. I lay naked outside the covers. Across from the bed, by the window, which was half covered by the shades, someone was sitting in the light of the red sun. It was Hare, in a white summer dress. Her legs were crossed. She was barefoot. Her dark hair was tied back. The sheer material was taut over her breasts. Her dangling arms were tanned to the elbows. She sat motionless, looking at me from under dark eyelashes. I gazed at her for a long time, entirely calm. My first thought was, I'm glad this is one of those dreams where you know you're dreaming. All the same, I'd have preferred her not to be there. I closed my eyes and began to wish this intensely, but when I opened them again, she was still sitting there. Her mouth was set in the way it always used to be, as if she was about to whistle, but her eyes weren't smiling in the slightest. I recalled everything I'd been thinking about dreams the previous evening before I fell asleep. She looked exactly like she had the last time I saw her alive. At that time, she'd only been 19 years old. Today she would have been 29, but naturally she hadn't altered. The dead remain young. She had the same eyes that were surprised at everything, and she was looking at me. I'll throw something at her, I thought, but though it was only a dream, I somehow couldn't bring myself to throw objects at a dead woman. "You poor little thing," I said. "You've come to visit me, huh?" I got a little scared because my voice sounded normal, and the whole room and Hare, it all looked as real as could be imagined. The dream was so vivid. Not only was it in color, on the floor I could also see a number of objects that I hadn't even noticed as I went to bed. When I wake up, I thought, I'll have to check whether they're actually there or whether they're a creation of my dream, like Hare. "Are you going to be sitting there much longer?" I asked, and I noticed I was speaking softly, like I was afraid someone might hear me, as if anyone could hear what happens in a dream. In the meantime, the red sun had risen a little higher. Even that much is good, I thought. I went to sleep during the red day, now it ought to be blue, and only after that would come the next red day. Well, I couldn't have possibly slept for 15 hours straight, so this was definitely a dream. Reassured, I studied Hare closely. She was lit from behind. A ray of light coming through a crack in the curtains gilded the velvety down on her left cheek and her eyelashes cast a long shadow on her face. She was lovely. How about that? I thought to myself. How exact I am, even when I'm not awake. I check the movement of the sun, and make sure she has that dimple of hers where nobody else has one, under the corner of her perpetually surprised mouth. All the same, I wished it would end. I need to get to work, after all. So I squeezed my eyelids shut, trying to wake up, when suddenly I heard a creak. I opened my eyes at once. She was sitting next to me on the bed, staring at me gravely. I smiled at her, and she smiled back and leaned over me. The first kiss was a light one, like one small child kissing another. I gave her a lingering kiss in return. Can a dream be exploited like that? I wondered. Though it's not even betraying her memory, because, after all, it was she herself I was dreaming about. This had never happened to me before. Still, we said nothing. I lay on my back. When she raised her face, I could see into her small nostrils, lit by the sun from the direction of the window, which were always a barometer of her feelings. I passed my fingertips over her ears, whose lobes had turned pink from kisses. I don't know if that was what unsettled me so. I kept telling myself it was a dream, but my heart contracted.